Well, among the admirers of the music we're going to hear in tonight's prom was the man who invented musique concrète, Pierre Henry, who had a pop hit with Psyche Rock in 1964, since remixed by Fatboy Slim, and who studied with Nadia Boulanger and Olivier Messiaen, who professes to love all music with a single exception of the hunting horn, and who had as his number one choice Bach's B minor mass. And at number two, Weasels Ripped My Flesh by Frank Zappa, plainly a man of impeccable taste. Well, there's no Frank Zappa or Fatboy Slim here in the Royal Albert Hall tonight. We're going to hear a performance of Bach's great masterpiece, the B minor mass. The performers come trailing clouds of Bachian glory. The choir and orchestra of the English concert and their conductor, Harry Bickett, have come fresh from Leipzig, where they gave the closing concert of this year's Bachfest with the B minor mass. And that was in Bach's own church, the Thomaskirche.
I'd never performed there before. I'd been to the church. In fact, we've been at the Bachfest before, but not in that church. To actually do the B minor mass in that building. Yes, I mean, it's the place where the Matthew Passion was first performed, where he wrote all those cantatas, where he spent so much of his life. It can't fail but send tingles down your spine. And they do the B minor mass every year as the closing concert of the Bachfest. So there's a sort of added pressure of the people who come year after year after year, hearing a whole lineup of every orchestra you can imagine and every conductor. So one tries not to feel like one's being judged, but well, you are for sure.
Tonight's conductor, Harry Bickett. Well, the B minor mass is one of the great monuments of Western music, yet it's also a big mystery. The scale is immense, the ambition vaulting, the difficulty extreme, the intensity unmistakable. But there are all sorts of oddities here. For a start, what's a devout Lutheran Protestant doing setting the Catholic Mass in Latin? And why does he create a work of such immense proportions that it was very unlikely ever to be performed? And anyway, haven't we heard some of the music before? It gives the impression of a patchwork quilt put together at the end of Bach's life from material, mainly cantatas, spanning the whole of his creative life. So it's in effect a showcase of his entire compositional endeavour. One possibility is, rather as people have suggested of the Monteverdi Vespers, that this is an elaborate job application. In 1733, when he was 48 and had been in his Leipzig post for 10 years and was maybe having something of a midlife crisis, Bach approached the Catholic court in Dresden for a snazzy title that would bolster his somewhat beleaguered position as the cantor at St. Thomas's School. Bach enclosed what he called a trifling product of his skill. This was the Kyrie and Gloria only of the Latin Mass. Well, those were actually among the parts of the Roman liturgy that Luther had kept as part of the Protestant service, so they could conceivably have been performed in the course of the liturgy in Leipzig. But the fact is, we don't have any evidence that these movements, which would become the first two main sections of the B minor Mass, were ever performed in Dresden or Leipzig, then or later. Well, I think you could probably hear an absolutely packed Albert Hall, the prom as packed as I've seen it this season. The English concert already on the platform here at Royal Albert Hall, with their leader, Nadia Zrina. And to perform the first two movements of Bach's Mass in B minor, here's the conductor, Harry Bickett, with tonight's soloists, Joel Harvey, Carolyn Sampson, Jessen Davis, Ed Lyon, and Matthew Rose.
Thank you.
That's the end of the Gloria of Bach's B minor Mass, which we're hearing in this live performance at the Royal Albert Hall as part of the 2012 BBC Proms. Tonight's soloists are sopranos Joel Harvey and Carolyn Sampson, countertenor Justin Davis, tenor Ed Lyon and bass Matthew Rose, with a choir and orchestra of the English Concert, conducted by Harry Bickett. Some fabulous playing of that, for me, at any rate, terrifying accompaniment to the bass aria from the young Danish horn player Ursula Halldan Monbeyer. I asked her if she wasn't going to be terrified of playing to an audience of 5,000. No, she said, just exciting. What was terrifying was playing in Bath's church, St. Thomas's, 6 weeks ago, standing up in the gallery and looking down at Bath's graves. But she said there were no rumblings, so I guess it must have been okay. Here are the soloists once again with Harry Bickett and all the choir and orchestra standing. Well, of course, the B minor Mass obviously doesn't end there. After the interval, we'll be hearing the Credo, Sanctus and Agnus Dei. A reminder that you can find programme notes for tonight's concert, including the text of the Mass, online via the Proms website. You can download them from there, and you can also listen to the B minor Mass in high-definition sound. Well, Danny Carlin is a professor at Bristol University and editor of the poetry of Robert Browning, who was born 200 years ago. In our interval tonight, he tries to defend what might be indefensible, a poem that's a strong candidate for the best worst poem in the language, or the greatest poem never read.
Imagine you are a young, ambitious poet, 2 months short of your 28th birthday. Your career has had a reasonably promising start, but your position is not yet secure, and a good deal hangs on the success of your next volume. It's a long narrative poem, 6,000 lines, and it has been nearly 5 years in the making. At last, however, the book appears from a leading poetry publisher. Review copies are sent out, and you distribute numerous others to friends and acquaintances. 2 weeks later, the first review appears in a high-profile weekly journal. It goes like this. What this poem may be in its extent, we are unable to say, for we cannot read it. Whatever may be the poetical spirit of the author, it is so overlaid by digression, affectation, obscurity, and all the faults that spring, it would seem, from crudity of plan and a self-opinion which will neither cull thoughts nor revise composition, that the reader, at least a reader of our stamp, turns away. Over the course of the next few weeks, other reviews appear, all singing the same tune. The whole structure is faulty, not only in its entire outline, but in its minutest details. He calls it poetry. We term it trash of the very worst description. A failure in toto. Unintelligible oozings of nonsense. Then stories start to circulate in the London literary world. Funny stories about how Mrs. X read the poem from cover to cover without being able to work out whether the title referred to a man, a city, or a book, or how Mr. Y opened it while convalescing from brain fever, read the first few pages and thought he'd lost his mind, until reassured by his wife that the poem was indeed gibberish. You stand accused of holding the ordinary reader in contempt. The sins of your verse, one critic announces, are premeditated, willful, and incurable. Needless to say, the book doesn't fly off the shelves. Nothing you can do mitigates the offence. You have a go at comprehensively revising the poem, but give it up as a bad job. It takes 25 years before your reputation even begins to recover. The poem on which you placed such high hopes is remembered only as one of those tremendous, awe-inspiring spectacles of literary catastrophe, relished by many more people than will ever read the actual book. And the worst thing of all is that this work, pelted with rotten vegetables and hooted from the stage, is a masterpiece, and you know it. You are Robert Browning, and the poem is Sordello. I want to say a word on behalf of this great poem, but I have to admit at the outset that nothing I or anyone can say is going to make it popular, even among lovers of poetry, even among lovers of Browning's poetry. Sordello really is a difficult poem, about as difficult as a poem can be without being completely impenetrable. I remember reading it for the first time, sitting in the old circular reading room of the British Museum, where Browning himself had researched his troubadour hero in old chronicles and history books. It was 1975, and I was about to start my PhD thesis on Browning, and I thought I'd better read Sordello in the first edition of 1840 to see what all the fuss was about. I think I understood one line in three, on average, and there were whole passages of the poem that I found utterly baffling, stumbling in the wake of an extended metaphor for several pages across a terrain of broken syntax, or losing the thread of long dialogues devoid of quotation marks, or struggling to remember who was related to whom in a dynastic plot of fiendish complexity set in medieval Italy, with no assistance whatsoever from the author, not a preface, not a note, not a genealogical chart. And yet, despite all this, the feeling I remember from that first reading is one of exhilaration. Through the fog there were glimpses of such imaginative power, such intensity of conception, such expressive energy and colour, that I was determined not only to get to the end of the poem, but to return to it, to learn its peculiar dialect, a variety of English spoken only in Sordello land, and which you can't master unless you go and live there. I need to give some idea of this dialect before going any further, because it's the first and most obvious barrier to anyone who thinks of tackling the poem. But I'm faced with a problem, because every part of the poem is closely dependent on a knowledge of the whole. That's the conundrum. In order to read Sordello, you have to have read Sordello. This principle applies to the confusing order of the episodes, the tortuous construction of the sentences, the jungle of metaphor, even the punctuation, or lack of it. So you'll have to take my word for it that the following example, taken from Book One, does make sense once you know its place and purpose in the whole design. We are being conducted deep into the interior of a palace in 13th century Verona. And it may help a little to know that a cresset is a torch or fire basket fixed to a wall, and the carax booming refers to a warning bell sounding the alarm in the streets outside. Glide we by clapping doors, with sudden glare of cressets vented on the dark, nor care for aught that's seen or heard, until we shut the smother in, the lights, all noises but the carax booming, safe at last. Why, strange, such a recess should lurk behind a range of banquet rooms. Your finger, thus, you push a spring, and the wall opens. Would you rush upon the banqueters, select your prey, waiting, the slaughter weapons in the way strewing this very bench, with sharpened ear a preconcerted signal to appear? Or if you simply crouch with beating heart, bearing in some voluptuous pageant part to startle them? Nor mutes, nor maskers now, nor any... Does that one man sleep, whose brow the dying lamp flame sinks and rises o'er? What woman stood beside him? Not the more is he unfastened from the earnest eyes because that arras fell between. Her wise and lulling words are yet about the room, her presence wholly poured upon the gloom, down even to her vesture's creeping stir. The narrative is cinematic, like a handheld camera, jerky, full of gaps, without a stable point of view. Another analogy might be that of a painting in which there's no perspective, in which everything is foreground, or in which there's a cubist overlapping of different planes. At one moment, the narrator is our guide, conducting us to the secret recess behind the banqueting rooms, explaining its purpose as though we've just asked him a question. Then it is as though we notice, with a shock, in the flickering light of a lamp, a man who may be asleep or in a trance. We're told a woman has just been with him, has just slipped behind that arras. Perhaps she is still there, we don't know. All we have is an evocation of her presence poured upon the gloom, that unmistakable feeling which everyone will recognise, of entering a room and knowing, without being able to say why, that someone has just been there. But though we realise that the man in the room is Sordello, the hero of the poem, we don't learn what he is doing there, or the identity of the woman, until nearly 2,000 lines later, in the middle of Book Three. Indeed, the whole scene, the secret recess in the palace in Verona, the reclining man, the mysterious woman, all this is about to vanish abruptly from the narrative. In another cinematic manoeuvre, a cut which takes us in a flashback to Sordello's boyhood 30 years before. No wonder readers in 1840 were angry. They didn't have cinema or cubist painting to measure the experimental daring of Browning's narrative technique. All they knew was that he was breaking every rule of the unwritten contract between author and reader that obtained in their own time. And he was doing it without giving them fair warning. Sordello didn't announce itself as an avant-garde assault on the sensibility of the common reader, and difficulty had not yet become an aesthetic value in literature. Browning wasn't Joyce or T.S. Eliot. If anything, he was a voice crying in the wilderness, prophesying the advent of modernism, and like John the Baptist, he was decapitated for his pains. The title of the poem promised something reasonably familiar, provided you knew your Dante, and more readers did in 1840 than nowadays, I suspect. Sordello was a real historical figure, a renowned Italian troubadour, who was born near Mantua towards the end of the 12th century. Dante encounters him in purgatory among the late repentant, standing apart with the air of a watchful lion, a figure of great poise and dignity. The title, then, tells you we're in the Middle Ages, in Dante's Italy, the Italy of warring city-states and mercenary captains, where the papacy struggled to assert its authority over whichever German dynasty happened to be in charge of the Holy Roman Empire. But the title also tells you that we are in the age of troubadours and minstrels, of chivalry and courtly love, and that we can expect as much action from the lute as from the sword. If you didn't know the poem better, you might think that Browning had chosen his genre and period with an eye to the market. Medieval subjects were popular, with Britain in the grip of the Gothic revival and Disraeli's Young England movement advocating a return to feudal values. Sir Walter Scott's poems and novels, especially Ivanhoe, had set the literary fashion for narratives of chivalry and romance. And the prestige of medieval ballads and lyrics was still strong. A story in verse, set in the romantic Middle Ages and full of fighting, intrigue, love and minstrelsy, that was what Sordello might have promised. Well, the experience of reading Sordello is not like that. True, the poem is a story, and it does contain all the elements of the kind of popular medieval romance I've just described. But these elements are mixed up with others to the point where they become unrecognisable. In this sense, the most famous joke about the poem, attributed to Tennyson, though there's no real evidence he ever made it, is perfectly correct. Tennyson is said to have declared that there were only two lines in Sordello he understood. The first, "Who will may hear Sordello's story told," and the last, "Who would has heard Sordello's story told," and that both these lines were lies. If Sordello's story means a conventional narrative of action or love, or even the story of a famous poet's career, then the poem is indeed a fraud on the public. But there's another way of looking at it, suggested by a phrase used by Browning himself, "incidents in the development of a soul." Sordello tells the story of a poet's journey from the all-encompassing egotism of genius to the humility and generosity of the true artist. Sordello begins by conceiving of himself as set apart from ordinary mortals, whose only function is to satisfy his insatiable appetite for worship. He ends by dedicating himself and his art to the cause of the people, at the cost of his life, and ironically, the extinction of his fame. At the climax of the poem, he is offered the chance to throw in his lot, both as poet and ruler, with the masters of the earth. And this chance is offered to him by the woman he loves and by his own father, the great warrior Torello Salinguera, who shows him the kingdoms of the earth and promises to fulfill his dream of dominion over mankind. But Sordello has seen too deeply into human suffering. With a supreme effort, he rejects the temptation and dies in the moment of his triumph. This triumph is also a terrible defeat, for Sordello's martyrdom redeems nobody but himself. The world goes on without him, as savage and bleak as though he had never lived or composed his beautiful songs. Browning is not peddling cheap spiritual uplift. The religious dimension of the poem is as tough-minded as any other. And Browning's own art is profoundly at issue here. In one of the most complex, subtle passages of this brain-bewildering poem, in the middle of Book Three, the poet suspends the action, steps outside the frame of his own work, and embarks on a long autobiographical digression, which occupies the remainder of Book Three, and which meditates on the place of poetry in the modern world, its mission, if you like. It springs from the poet's encounter in Venice with a haggard, ghostly figure who accosts him like a beggar or a prostitute and who symbolizes suffering humanity, the muse who awakens or reawakens the radical energy Browning needs both to finish his poem and to move beyond it. I should add that this ragged muse replaces in Browning's imagination the young, recently crowned Queen Victoria, to whom he had been on the point of dedicating his poem, with all the vanity and self-display that he attributes to its hero. He, too, is saved just in time. Like Dante Sordello, he is one of the late repentant. But the difference is that he is alive and able to take the second chance he is given. In one sense, the poem may truly be said to end here, since everything that follows is determined by this moment of revelation. Sordello's story is subsumed into a larger story, the story of Sordello, of Browning's poem. We find it hard to warm to works of art that comment on themselves. It's become such a cliché of modern writing, this mirror-gazing and reflexive self-awareness. It's not a recommendation to say that Sordello is about Sordello. It's a decisive turn-off. But Browning's poem is absolutely not a precious, arty piece of look-at-me soul-searching. The personal is political, both for the poem's hero and its author. You might say the poetical is political. Ideas are not inert, but active principles. What an artist believes ought to enter into and shape their work. In Sordello, this active principle is republicanism, democracy, the cause of the common people. It bends everything to its will, genre, character, style. It asks readers to form a new kind of relationship with poetry, a relationship in which they share both power and responsibility with the poet. Let me conclude by showing how this principle works at the most basic level of any narrative, the level of exposition. In a passage in Book One, too lengthy to quote here, Browning describes the struggle between two great forces in northern Italy, that of the feudal nobles who owe allegiance to the Holy Roman Empire, and that of the common people who depend on the protection of the papacy. How does Browning convey this necessary information? Not in plain words, that's for sure. He gives us an extended metaphor in which the nobles are islands jutting up from the sea after an earthquake, which represents the eruption of imperial power, while the common people are a chokeweed a dense mass of vegetation that threatens to spread over the rocky outcrops and obliterate their features, meaning that the autocratic power and privileges of the few would disappear as the many gained political control. The nobles want the emperor to intervene. They want a second earthquake to rid them of this encroaching weed of popular power. The common people want the weed to grow and grow, nurtured by the benevolent sunshine of the papacy, until it covers the whole ocean, a surface solid now, continuous, one, an ideal society in which there is no political and social hierarchy. The metaphor itself is not that hard to understand. But the more you think about it, the odder it becomes. The cause we're supposed to sympathize with, the cause of the common people, is represented by a noxious, spreading weed. At the beginning of the passage, Browning actually uses the word scum to describe what the weed looked like when it first began to grow. Think of the slimy algae that we so dislike in our rivers and ponds. And scum is, of course, a familiar term of contempt for the underclass, the mob. I can't think of any other poem in which it is used in a positive sense. Yet here, this scum may, just may, given the right conditions, grow into the people, the true sublime of a democratic republic. It's a slow, complex process, beautifully rendered by the image of the weed developing new clasps, ties, filaments, a multitudinous network of social relations. And poetry is implicated in this process. The image of the chokeweed as a good thing is disconcerting, to say the least. Who wants to identify with that? Who would not rather identify with an earthquake or a jutting cliff? Aren't these grand, sublime aspects of nature the stuff of poetry? They are indeed. That's the point of rejecting them here. We're being asked to imagine what the world looks like if we invert a scale of values we thought immutable, unchallengeable. And if we can do it for a metaphor, perhaps we can do it for what the metaphor represents. Ultimately, the greatness of Sordello lies in this revolutionary invitation to imagine a new order of things. But the invitation is, alas, uninviting. "I look at you every day as a monkey does at a coconut," Ruskin once wrote to Browning, having great faith in the milk, hearing it rattle indeed, inside, but quite beside myself for the fibres. The fibres of Sordello have grown, if anything, tougher and huskier with the years. It is certainly capable of making monkeys of its readers. But for anyone brave enough to crack the toughest nut in English poetry, I guarantee that the milk is still inside.
The Greatest Poem Never Read was presented by Danny Carlin and produced in Bristol by Tim Dee. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and the second part of this proms performance of Bach's B Minor Mass, given by the choir and orchestra of the English Concert, conducted by Harry Bickett. Earlier on, I spoke to Harry Bickett and he talked about the sheer pleasure of performing this music, despite the many challenges of presenting it here in the Royal Albert Hall.
It's music of such genius. One of the great beauties of this piece is that no one I know of my orchestra or choir or any of the soloists ever tire of returning to it again and again and again. So, in a way, that part of my job is easy. The physical difficulties of playing it are something else. And obviously in a space as big as the Albert Hall, taking a piece that has a certain sort of virtuosity, which is easier to achieve with smaller forces, trying to do that with the larger forces in such a huge space requires simple technical problems of the chorus being about half a mile away from me, trying to coordinate the bassoons that are a quarter of a mile away from them. But I love listening to Bach on the piano. I love doing the Bach B minor mass with huge forces. I love doing it with small forces. The music transcends all of this.
Tonight's conductor, Harry Bickett. We rejoin the B minor mass for the credo, The avowal of Christian faith is a movement unbelieving composers have been known to leave out altogether. Not Bach, of course, the devout Lutheran for whom it amounts to half the duration of the entire Mass. At the centre of the Credo are the trio of movements concerned with Christ's incarnation, crucifixion and resurrection. It emerges as the most moving and dramatic sequence of the whole Mass, as perhaps it should be. After the sombre, drooping phrases of the Crucifixus, Bach shatters the stillness with an explosion of ecstatic joy, for et resurrexit, and the third day he rose again. The next movement, the Sanctus, Holy, 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 Lord God of Hosts, is a conspicuous example of Bach's compulsive number symbolism. The word Sanctus is repeated three times in the liturgy, three times in the music, which is also shot through with triplets. The entire fabric sways in glorious propulsion, an extended shout of triumph for the choir, underpinned by pealing trumpets and exuberant timpani. The Sanctus goes straight into the Hosanna in Excelsis, and the final section of this mighty work sets the Agnus Dei for a solo voice and the Dona Nobis Pacem for the choir, whose music's identical to the Gratias, the thanksgiving section of the Gloria of this very work, a masterstroke of economy and a profound piece of theological symbolism. Here's Harry Bickett once again with the soloists, Joel Harvey, Yestin Davis, Ed Lyon and Matthew Rose, to continue this proms performance of Bach's B minor Mass.
Thank you. In spiritum sanctum dominum et vivificante. Et in spiritum sanctum dominum et vivificante. Vivificante, Spiritum Sanctum, Vivificante Dominum, qui ex Patre Filio, quae Quicum Patre
the final Agnus Dei and Dona Nobis Pacem of Bach's B minor Mass. The last bass entry in the chorus, reinforced so spectacularly by the drums, which have been silent for a long while, seeming to defy disbelief and proclaim unquenchable faith, which Bach surely needed, his death only a year away at the time he composed that music. Well, maybe not quite the wall of sound which greeted those women rowers, but an impressive noise here in the Royal Albert Hall for that performance. The soloists in Bach's B minor Mass were Joel Harvey, Yestin Davis, Ed Lyon, and Matthew Rose. In his case, singing the bass part for the first time with the choir of the English concert and the instrumentalists of the English concert leader, Nadia Zwina. The performance conducted by Harry Bickett. When I spoke to him earlier, he said that some of Bach's music is so complex, so difficult to perform. You look at certain lines and think he must have had superhuman singers who could perform that without taking a breath. Sometimes, Bickett says, he just wrote, "This is what my offering is. As human beings, if we can perform it, then I think we somehow get closer to godliness." Soloists returning to the platform with Harry Bickett, greeted by those tremendous cheers. 6 weeks ago, on the 17th of June, they performed the Mass. That roar for the choir of the English concert. They performed the Mass in Bach's own church, St. Thomas's. Then they were rather slenderer in number, just four to a part tonight. For the more spacious acoustic of the Royal Albert Hall, seven to a part. There's cheers for Katerina Spreckelsen and Hannah McLaughlin, the oboists, flautist Lisa Vesnosiuk and Guy Williams, trumpeters Mark Bennett, Michael Harrison and Michael Laird. A cheer for Nadia Zwina. And we shouldn't forget the man standing throughout playing the organ, Benjamin Bale. Cheer there for Jonathan Crouch, who spoke very amusingly in the pre-prom talk, telling us that to convey the changes of rhythm to his colleagues in the section, he'd be bouncing about like Boris Johnson on a zip wire. Well, you can hear tonight's concert, as all the proms, online for 7 days after the event, using the Listen Again facility, highly recommended. That's just to mention that Composer of the Week, which has been featuring the Bach B minor Mass movement by movement, reaches its end tomorrow at 12. But for now, time for me to hand you back to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House.
Donald, thank you there. Donald MacLeod there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to add, there's another chance to hear that joyous performance of the B minor Mass here on BBC Radio 3 on Friday afternoon next week at 2 o'clock. Well, a slightly later start time for tomorrow night's prom. It brings that most intimate of Wagner pieces, the Siegfried Idyll, along with an Everest among symphonies, Bruckner's Eighth, with Donald Runicles conducting the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. That's at 7:45 tomorrow night. And there's more Bruckner in next Tuesday night's prom.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Bruckner's Sixth Symphony. The BBC Philharmonic and its new principal conductor, Juanjo Mena, fresh from an acclaimed Proms debut earlier in the season. And the world premiere of a new work by a composer closely associated with the orchestra, James McMillan. Tuesday night, BBC Radio 3 at 7:30.
Yes, it should be good. You may remember Juanjo Mena's Bruckner Sixth Symphony with the BBC Philharmonic and a Radio 3 Live in concert a few weeks ago. A glorious performance, rhythmically alive, vivid in colour and paced to perfection. As David Fanning wrote afterwards in the Telegraph, "Rarely have I heard a Bruckner Sixth that displayed such masterful long-term vision, and never, I think, one that made the work seem so important." Their prom opens with Wagner's Tristan Prelude, followed by James McMillan's Credo, and the Bruckner Sixth Symphony is in the second half. That's next Tuesday night, live from the Royal Albert Hall, here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, starting at 7:30. As for the present, in just under 5 minutes, out in the world, a global gay history. Richard Coles continues his study of same-sex desire across the centuries. For the moment, Bruckner, on a smaller scale from his symphonies, one of his motets, a setting of the Ave Maria. The singers are the choir of the Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted by a man who had Bruckner in his bones, Eugen Jochum. A setting of the Ave Maria by Bruckner. The singers were the choir of the Deutsche Oper Berlin, conducted by Eugen Jochum. And as I was saying, Bruckner's Eighth Symphony is in tomorrow night's prom, the prom itself starting at 8:15. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 10 o'clock, and now Richard Coles continues his excavation of same-sex desire across the centuries In Out in the World, a Global Gay History, first broadcast last year. Tonight, in a programme which explores India, Polynesia and native North America, Richard's focus is on imperialism and its legacy. He starts, though, a little closer to home.
I'm standing practically nestled into the bosom of the Mother of Parliaments here in Westminster. Big Ben right behind me, and I'm outside Portcullis House, the modern office block just opposite Big Ben, where I'm joining a queue of people, a long queue of people, who are all the guests of the Speaker tonight at a reception in Parliament to launch a group called Kaleidoscope. Kaleidoscope aims to promote particularly justice and equality for lesbian and gay people in Africa and Asia, where there have been some quite extraordinarily hostile attitudes around issues of sexuality just lately. It's the launch night tonight, so I've come to meet some people here. One of the founders of Kaleidoscope is Lance Price.
In a lot of those countries, if you look around the world at the countries where there is still criminal sanctions, effectively just for being a homosexual, a lot of them are Commonwealth countries, and a lot of the legislation that remains in place is the legacy, if you like, of colonialism. The laws were first put onto the statute book when we, the British, and others were colonial powers.
When the ambitious European nations went out into the world in the era of colonial expansion, they found a startling, to them, range of sexual expression. In this programme, we'll look at how that encounter raises all kinds of questions about the relationship between sexuality and gender, about how the powerful impose their values on those whom they dominate, about the different ways people think of their bodies and how they're defined by them, questions which have proved remarkably persistent. Professor Bill Nafee of Aberdeen University.
I think it would be fair to say that there are almost no cultures that the British and the West more generally come in contact with during the era of colonialism, say from 1500 onwards, where they do not find same-sex behaviour tolerated. Openly tolerated in a way that they would never have allowed.
They discovered boy wives, they discovered different sorts of transvestism.
Professor Robert Aldrich of the University of Sydney.
They discovered societies such as that of Japan, where certain types of homosexual behavior were not just tolerated but celebrated. In pre-colonial North America, as well as in the South Pacific, there are third sex or third gender persons that did not fit into our categories.
The British and more generally Europeans perceive this activity at any level for any reason as a sign of gross immorality and degeneracy.
And did that give force to the desire to legislate?
Yes, getting rid of the inherent sort of weakness. These cultures are perceived to be somehow feminized. They've become non-masculine, and that needs to be beaten or bred out of them.
Gay Pride Parade in Delhi. In 2009, after years of campaigning by activists, India repealed Section 377 of its penal code, which criminalized sexual activity against the order of nature. It had been on the statute books for nearly 150 years and reflected, it seems, the attitudes of the British who brought it rather than the Indians who were bound by it. And that rather vague wording, against the order of nature, reflects a reality in which sexual practice and gender identity was complex.
For example, Kliba, Shanda, Pandaka, Napamsaka, Titya Pakriti, Varshadhara and Kashaba.
Dr. Shane Gannon of Mount Royal University in Calgary.
These very terms were pointing to a non-hegemonic form of sexuality. They were pointing to something that the British really didn't understand.
The most obvious example of where the British find a different mental world, which they simply are never able to grasp, is in India with the third gender, the not man, not woman, the Hijras. The British find this utterly incomprehensible and revolting.
Modern day Mumbai. Like a flower on landfill, in an area one step up from a slum, Abina Aher stands out. dancer, makeup artist, choreographer, and dressed today in a kurta, a long tunic top just above the knees, a dupatta, a shoulder scarf, and traditional leggings. Heels, makeup complete the look, but what sort of look? For Abhina is neither male nor female.
I describe myself as a hijra. A hijra is somebody who's not male or female. It's a third gender.
Abhina has male genitals and male sexual partners. Her dress is definitely feminine, but not because she wants to identify or be identified as a woman.
Deep down the heart, the identification of gender comes as a third gender, not as a female. Because females are different than us. We are something different. We are completely different than a female.
Abhina felt different from a very early age.
My mother is a dancer, and my father was an instrument player. I picked up my dance and a rhythm from my mother and father, and I used to love to cross-dress.
During her college years, Abhina was deeply confused trying to work out who she was.
I did this performance in drag, and I slowly started thinking that I really like this. Whenever female clothes touch to my body, I feel nice. I feel myself. I feel it within my shoes. I started cross-dressing for some time and started realizing the fact that is, whenever I cross-dress, I feel inner happiness, I feel mental peace. I really adore this expression. All these signals were actually triggering in my mind and saying that is, I'm something different. It's just not about my sexuality, it's much more beyond that. I found out this group of hijras, and then I started staying with them, talking to them and understanding their perspective about life. And then on one day I decided that what I am. I want to be the way I am.
Hijras live a defined and strictly codified way of life.
First rule that comes is that you have to grow your hair like a woman. You're not supposed to cut your hair. Second rule that comes is I can't shave. I have to pluck my hair from my face. Then you have to wear three clothes, which means teen kapda. If you are wearing Indian attire, either you can wear a salwar kameez, which is the Indian garment, or otherwise you have to wear a sari, which is a normal traditional sari. Other thing is that I have to wear a full clothes. I'm not supposed to show off my body.
Traditionally, hijras lived at an angle to the wider society, set apart and occupying a particular spiritual role.
If you have a childbirth, we will come to your place, we will bless the child, and we will do dancing and ceremony and all that sort of things. And in return, we will take some money from you to bless your child and bless your family. Because hijras are considered in India and other Asian countries divine, which is something which is very special. That was a classical work. If you look at the Indian culture, if you look at the Indian history, then hijras were at the superior powers. They were actually well-wishers of kings and queens. They used to take care of harems. So, and they were like really in a superior position. But after post-British invasion, hijras have been suppressed in the corner and they've been shunned down.
The Victorians just took one look at it and said, we don't care what you call it, that's sodomy.
Professor Bill Nafee.
In many ways, the Victorians just simply ignore the fact that these cultures see them as being intermediate genders and reclassify them.
So what happened was they took these notions and effectively collapsed these varied activities into a framework which was necessarily Western. So they describe them as homosexual, even though they completely miss the subtleties, the indigenous understandings of these activities.
This fundamental misconception confuses our thinking now as much as it did in the colonial era. Dr. Shane Gannon.
There isn't the easy separation between sexuality and gender and sex that we assume in Western understandings of sexuality. So especially in the 19th century in the West, we separated those three. There's male and there's female. That's one separate category. There's gender, there's masculine and there's feminine. And then there's sexuality. And these are all three different analytical categories. That is not the experience of other groups.
Being hijra is much more beyond your sexual desires.
Abhina is quick to challenge the assumption that being hijra equates with homosexuality.
A lot of gay men been called as hijras, knowingly, unknowingly, because people don't see any big difference among them, but it is not the same. Hijras is much more different and unique than a gay man. if a gay man approaches me for a sexual act or even a relationship, I'll say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested.
And this has far-reaching consequences for those engaged in trying to construct a history of homosexuality.
Soon as you have this different embodiment, you're no longer a male, female, but you have something else in addition, suddenly the terms we have for sexuality fail. How can you have homosexuality when homo assumes two, or hetero assumes two? How can you understand sexuality in these contexts when you suddenly have a third? So our understanding of sexuality is fundamentally flawed in the South Asian context because we're trapped by our very language.
Does this discussion of gender categories belong in a history of homosexuality at all?
What we risk, just looking at the West and Western notions, is effectively reifying that as the norm, as the natural, and that's very, very dangerous.
If you say that you're talking about homosexuality, multiple genders doesn't have a place. If, on the other hand, you say what you're talking about is same-sex activities and same-sex relationships, then yes, it does belong, because then what you should be saying is some societies look at same-sex behavior, activities, individuals, and see asexuality. Other societies look at that and see a gender.
But the Western model pretty much buys into a fundamental binary about gender.
It does. It looks at, to be blunt, it looks at genitalia and sees gender. Other societies don't.
And there are rather literal illustrations of that from the early explorers.
William Bligh, for example, the infamous captain of the Bounty, puts on his white glove when he meets a Tahitian Mahu and puts his hand up the pareo, the skirt, of the transgender person of the Mahu that he encountered in Tahiti and describe what he was feeling, whether there were genitals there or not.
Professor Nico Besnier of the University of Amsterdam, an anthropologist who studied Polynesia. You could say Captains Cook and Bligh went out into the world curiously in the spirit of the Enlightenment. The missionaries who followed them, however, had a rather different attitude.
The London Missionary Society arrives in Tahiti in the late 1700s, if I remember correctly, 1799. And these people are Reformed Protestants, they are Puritans, and of course they are scandalized by the way they see. Not only is there transgender, which they call the unspeakable sexual practices, but they find infanticide, they find all sorts of practices that they all bundle together and say these people are dreadful heathens, they must be converted immediately.
In India, so in the South Asian context, Act 27 of 1871, Part 2 was called the Eunuch Act. In creating this law, there was a whole bunch of different groups that the British didn't like. It turns out it wasn't just the Hijra. There were a whole bunch of different groups. Anyone who cross-dressed, anyone who committed male-male sexual intercourse, anyone who was differently bodied, that would include eunuchs and hermaphrodites, all of these people were included under the Eunuch Act and therefore became considered Hijra. So you end up with this huge collapsing of categories in 1871.
But it wasn't just the British. In South America too, the conquistadors were determined to impose a rigid Western view.
They are obviously most shocked by human sacrifice. The second thing they're most shocked by is the fact that sodomy is openly practiced. The Spanish look at those societies and they see the most demonic, satanic societies that Christians have ever encountered. This then means that they will, if they convert them to Christianity, have triumphed over the most demonic and satanic cultures they've ever encountered. They obliterate as much of their writing as possible, so Aztec and Maya books are destroyed wholesale as quickly as they can get their hands on them, to disconnect these people from their past, from their histories, from their traditions, so that with a clean slate, they can fix them. For the Spanish, that's almost a godsend. In fact, they perceive of it as such. Here is their chance to win for Christianity, for Catholicism, people who have been utterly controlled and dominated by Satan.
Not very far from the British Museum in Bloomsbury in central London is Hoxton, which is one of those sort of liminal neighbourhoods between gentrified Islington and working class Hackney. And the museum here has a repository for some of the items that it can't show in its main building, and we've come to see one of them. and one that is particularly relevant for our story. A rather precious object to which I've been allowed special access. It records a dramatic, indeed tragic episode, and it gives us a revealing example of the multiple gender phenomenon. The storage facility is in a nondescript back street in a nondescript building, a world away from the impressive marble halls of the museum the public knows. Curator Max Carocci takes me up in a lift itself, something of a relic.
How many floors of stuff?
There's five floors.
And this is all stuff that you just don't have room to show in the museum?
The collections are, significantly larger than what the museum can display.
But the item I've come to see is here because it's particularly susceptible to degradation from light damage. It's a textile from the North American collection. Just coming into quite a large room, and round the edges there are desks and tables. In the centre, two tables put together. And on it, the object we've come to see, it's been unwrapped from tissue paper, and it's about the size of a large headscarf, plain, looks like cotton to me. And on it, there are drawn in what looks like sort of charcoal or graphite of some kind, figures, some of them coloured with red, but figures which are obviously telling the story of what was happening in the life of the culture that this object came from. Max, what is this we're looking at?
This is what is known as a winter count. A winter count is a chronological description of events that have happened over, in this case, more than 100 years among a particular tribe of Native North Americans. So it starts with the late 18th century and basically finishes at the beginning of the 20th century.
And do we know which tribe where these Plains Indians were? This
particular winter count apparently comes from the Yankton-Yanktonai Dakota Indians of the northern plains of the United States.
Looking at these figures in the winter count at the edge, I mean, they're very simple, almost cartoonish. Some wearing headdresses, some with long hair, some with coloured garments. There's animals, there's horses.
Yes, there is a very important icon here where you see all these little crosses. Effectively, these are stars. This is the year when the stars fell. And a meteorite passed through the Dakota skies, and it was recorded as the year when the stars fell. Or episodes of epidemics, such in this case, where you see people with smallpox with all the dots on the body. This is a deer dance, for instance, where you can quite clearly make out the costume or the regalia used, worn by the deer dancers.
In all this sort of pageant of events and figures, there's one in particular that attracts our attention. It's on the inner spiral, and there's a figure, and it looks like a woman wearing a skirt with long hair, and she's standing in what looks like almost a sort of gibbet, because there's a cord from her neck hanging from one beam of the gibbet. It looks like someone either being hanged or hanging herself.
That is correct. In fact, this image depicts the suicide of a Winkte. It is a man-woman, a person called Grass, who killed herself by hanging. This must have happened around the latter part of the 19th century, that is 1890, 1891, and it shows in the icon the rope attached to her neck and what appears to be a structure. We don't know what kind of structure this was. And she chose that particular way of killing herself because it was the way in which women chose to end their life.
And what do we know about Winktes? What was their function within the group?
We know quite a lot about Winktes. Among the Dakota, this is a Dakota term that means once to be a woman, were considered almost like an in-between gender. That is, a gender that did not fall within the parameters of neither a man or a woman, and was virtually classified according to the tasks that he or she was performing. And I say he or she because sometimes we could have individuals of a female sex that would take on scales, occupations, and tasks of socially recognized men.
In the indigenous cultures of the Americas, it's very well documented that there was some form of multiple genders in almost every culture.
Professor Brian Gilley of Indiana University.
Whether you're talking about Mesoamerica, the Andes, the far northern parts of Canada, and there would be multiple genders, I think even more than what we have historically documented or what we've been able to fetter out of documents.
In Western cultures, such figures might often be seen as problematic by the majority. Was it difficult being a Winkte in a Dakota tribe, or was it something that had some sort of status?
It had a certain status, if anything, because in effect they were imbued with spiritual power, with a spiritual power that could not be recognized among generally accepted women or men. And so because of this particular status, of this, you know, this spirituality associated with this figure, they had a special place, effectively, in the tribe. So they had specific ritual roles. They had specific roles in terms of matchmakers, for instance, between males and females. They were also organizing dances. They were organizing festivities.
It's interesting, almost as kind of non-combatants themselves, they became honest brokers in those sometimes complex social situations.
Absolutely. In fact, they were bringing together any number of things that can be brought together, extremes or opposites. And so, effectively, they were almost encompassing both genders. They were transcending both genders. They were neither man nor woman, but both.
But how did one become a Winkte?
That person, as a child, would be watched. And if they showed a proclivity for sewing with their aunts or only wanting to hang out with women or interested in weaving or a kind of effeminity, then that child would be then socialized through the major rites of passage in life as a Winkte. So it was a gender role that was already established, and then an individual would then be socialized into that role. Now, how that manifested in sexuality is the puzzling thing.
We know from ethnohistorical sources that people of this category often were homosexuals, but not necessarily always so. In fact, in comparison to other tribes where similar figures existed, they could even have children.
When you say homosexual,
yes,
what do you mean?
Homosexual would, in this case, be a sexual contact between two bodies with the same genitalia.
Right. Can we kind of construct anything on that? Are there kind of issues around identity that might arise from that, or is that an impossible question to answer, indeed not proper to ask?
We tend to construct identity in accordance to both genitals and sexual proclivities. This is not necessarily the same with Native American tribes, especially Native American tribes of the historic period, that is before reservations. And that is because a sexuality or sexual proclivities or erotic desire did not actually make the person any particular identity. That is, so sexuality was effectively detached from their gender identity that these typologies of people may adopt.
Is this a particularly significant item in the collection, Max?
It is a very important object in the British Museum collections, if anything, because with regard to the history of lesbian and gay people, it's one of the very few existing images drawn by the peoples themselves.
And it's an often overlooked fact that it wasn't simply those with male genitals who could be Winkte or other tribal equivalents.
The fact that male and female-bodied people had varied gender roles is something that scholars have fallen down on. We haven't done as much analysis on female-bodied persons. Historically, I think one of the reasons why we don't have as much historic interpretation is because people who were writing this stuff down weren't as interested in women living together, women seeming to be partners or whatever. I think that they were mostly focused on men having sexual relations or men living together. And so this was the abomination of all abominations. And so thus it was very well documented by priests who were on these expeditions and conquistadors and so forth.
Expeditions which ultimately led to the extinction of the practices, even among the Dakota tribe, which resisted the white man's advance longer than many others.
They are looking at this saying, this is an abomination. You know, you have male-bodied people sleeping together, married, cohabitating, so forth, and so having sex. And so they then went about systematically killing those people. So in most communities, except for a handful, it completely disappeared in the first couple hundred years of colonization.
In the case of the British, what's driving this desire to stamp out the diversity of forms of gender and sexual expression? In part, it was events nearer to home, for in France, as a result of the introduction of the Napoleonic Code in 1804, the act of sodomy was no longer a crime, and Frenchmen were now free to get up to same-sex stuff. Professor Bill Nafee.
I think it's worth remembering how incredibly violent the French Revolution appears to people who are watching it across the channel. and trying to answer the question of what's wrong with these people? Why are they so seemingly insane as to want to turn the world upside down? One of the things that people latch onto is that they are utterly degenerate in their sexual mores. They have no sense of true morals of right and wrong, and they reject God and all of his works. A dangerous force, a degenerate force.
So the mood of intolerance abroad is mirrored by a new repressive climate at home. But the way the authorities seek to address this is paradoxical.
They begin to decrease the number of crimes for which death is a penalty. And one of the reasons they do that is they find that during the course of the middle of the 19th century, juries are increasingly unwilling to convict if the penalty is going to be death. So in actual fact, in an attempt to increase convictions, they effectively introduce the idea of gross indecency. That's what Oscar Wilde gets done for. The importance of that is it's much easier to convict someone for gross indecency than the previous charge of sodomy, which carried the death penalty. So you are much more likely after the middle of the 19th century to go to prison for gross indecency, i.e. for sexual relations with another man. And because it's on hard labour, the chances are you're not going to survive.
A new dimension here in the story of colonisation. Repression, certainly, but opportunities too. Professor Robert Aldrich of the University of Sydney.
Contrarywise, for some of the Europeans who were homosexual, those experiences, those discoveries of different sexualities overseas were emancipating. They showed that for some societies, the unnatural sin was rather natural, that what in Europe was considered a crime, an illness, a disease, was not so considered in the wider world.
In the wake of the Oscar Wilde trials, British society polarised, I think. You had labels like homosexual and heterosexual becoming fixed.
Professor Steph Newell has researched the life of John Murray Stuart Young, who claimed to have been at Wilde's bedside when he died. What a crowded scene that was. Although it's hard to rescue fact from fiction from this notably unreliable witness, Young's is an interesting commentary on the elusive nature of identity and homosexuality. He was born in a working-class area of Manchester in 1881 as plain John Young.
By the time he was 19, he'd established himself through embezzlement from his employer as a bourgeois literary gentleman, a young literary gentleman in a posh part of Manchester. So what we've got emerging here is somebody whose identity from the outset is multiple, complex, reinvented by himself, and particularly through forgery. So he ended up in prison at the age of 19, as he was found out, and he had 6 months with hard labour. And then he went to West Africa from there to start his life again.
Young fled partly because of his criminal notoriety, but also to escape escalating intolerance towards homosexuality back home in England.
Particularly as a working class young man, he constantly was trying to get away from those roots, not as a rejection of class, perhaps, but as a way to find himself sexually outside British labelling systems.
Young established himself as a very successful palm oil trader, visiting a number of Western African countries, but ending up in Nigeria, where Professor Steph Newell spoke to locals who remembered him.
There's a very interesting set of responses to Stuart Young when he arrived in Onitsha, which is a town. Then it was a very small trading post in eastern Nigeria. And the two sets of responses to him were very different because the white colonial observers of Stuart Young instantly identified him with a queer stereotype. However, Africans were also observing Stuart Young, this white man in their midst, and commenting on him, labelling him, naming him. And this is where his story becomes really interesting, because what we've got here